whatever the virtues, sorry, in order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart, I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart, I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart, I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening and welcome back. Nice to see everyone. So tonight we'll finish up from, So tonight we'll finish up from last class where we didn't get to the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra. Let's see, what pages? Here we go. So we are on, let's see, it's page 160 of the source book, the holy teaching of Vimalakirti, glorious, pure, well known as being pure. Vimala is purity and Kirti is glorious or renowned. So this sutra is actually a little bit out of place chronologically in our progression because it's clearly a later Mahayana sutra, and we see a significant difference in the style between this sutra and the Prajnaparamita sutra, which by comparison seemed very rough. It's like very choppy, and its literary style is very undeveloped in the Prajnaparamita sutras by comparison. And in the Vimalakirti, it's like the Prajnaparamita sutra is just like a series of little snippets that repeat themselves endlessly. And there's very little sense of a progression of either a story or coverage of topics in the Prajnaparamita texts, which is one reason that later there's many teachers and texts that focus on compiling, condensing the Prajnaparamita sutras into its main topics. Most notably a text by Maitreya, the future Buddha, called Abhisamaya Alamkara, which condenses in particular the 25,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra and I think the 80,000 line and the 8,000 line into a text of about 30 pages. And is said to thereby cover all the points covered in all the other Prajnaparamita Sutras. By contrast, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra, the teaching of Vimalakirti, is like a story. It's a really well-crafted story, and it's a great story also. And so we see at the beginning of this story, we're at the second chapter, and the first chapter that we did not include here goes through basically all the different people that were assembled at this one time when the Lord Buddha was in residence in the Garden of Amrapali in the city of Aishravana, attended by a great gathering. And then it goes into, it's the beginning of the first chapter, And it talks about their qualities of the assembly of arhats and bodhisattvas, and goes through them in great detail. And it talks about Buddha fields. It's like one of the most interesting conversations about Buddha fields. What is a Buddha field? Which is a whole different topic that we're not going to go into tonight. But instead, we have the second chapter, which is the introduction to Vimalakirti. So at that time, there lived in the great city of Vaishali a certain Lichavi. The name of the people there, Vimalakirti by name. And we hear all of the amazing qualities of what a bodhisattva is, as embodied, as represented by Vimalakirti. He's just amazing in all ways. But in worldly ways, unlike the Buddha himself was amazing in worldly ways until he renounced the world, and then he was amazing in terms of his practice of austerity and meditation, and then obviously in terms of his accomplishment of Buddhahood. But Vimalakirti is amazing in terms of his combining of the qualities of a noble person and his participation in the world without being stained by the world. A perfect example of a bodhisattva who is in the world but not of the world. And I think I'll leave it at that for that chapter. Chris, do you want to add anything for that to that?
Just to elaborate on him being unstained by the world, that includes certain activities that we might think of as unwholesome, such as associating in gambling halls or in brothels, as we see mentioned here, in order to reach beings in those places. So you can imagine how provocative that might have been.
Yeah, it seems totally like very specifically and carefully oriented to provoke outrage or at least shock factor.
In addition to him just being, fabulously wealthy and living this life of total opulence. Or perhaps we should say a life of apparent opulence.
Yeah, where do you see the opulence?
Well, we do have descriptions of him living in, a palace, right, of some sort.
Is that right?
I'm not sure it's in this chapter. It may be when we are first entering his house.
Because he makes his house empty,
He makes his house
usually.
empty, right? But it's still certainly large enough to accommodate this massive gathering.
Yeah, in the fifth chapter it says, then magically his house became empty, even the doorkeeper. So he had a doorkeeper and disappeared except for the couch upon which he lay. No better couch or seat could be seen anywhere. But there is a comment about, like, how are we all going to fit in this house? And he says, no problem. We can fit thousands of beings in this space. It's similar to what Milarepa does. Much, much later, fighting in a yak horn in a hail during a hailstorm to without getting smaller, without the yak horn getting bigger. But yeah, he's a successful guy. He's a successful businessman, and it's an unusual quotient of human being, a characterization of a Dharma practitioner for sure, successful in all ways. So then we have, we skip ahead to the ninth chapter, the Dharma Door of Non-Duality. And just briefly, what happens in between is that the Buddha learns of Vimalakirti being sick, And he asks his students to go pay respects to Vimalakirti on his behalf, and one after another they decline, saying his wit is just far beyond mine, and whenever I see him, he makes fun of me. He like destroys me in terms of my understanding of the Dharma and my just like knowledge and ability to function. And he goes through one after another of his main arhats that feature in the early sutras, and then he goes through a number of bodhisattvas, and they decline as well. And finally, Manjushri rouses, says, "Yeah, no problem. I'll go see this fun character." And everybody goes off to see him. And just one more thing to set up this chapter is that when they get there, they ask him about his illness, and he says, "I'm ill because all sentient beings are ill. I'm not really sick. I'm just sick because all sentient beings are sick with craving and delusion of samsara, and therefore I am sick." Because this sense that a bodhisattva sort of absorbs, takes on the suffering, the experience, the struggle of everybody in the world. And lastly, to set this up, they finally all assemble. Vimalakirti creates lotuses and thrones for all of them to sit on, and the house somehow accommodates all of these beings on big lotus pods and thrones. And oh, sorry, there's one good one where they first come in and they say, "Oh, there's nowhere to sit. Where are we going to sit?" And or they're thinking that, they're like looking around. You can imagine them looking around, shrugging their shoulders. And Vimalakirti says, "Did you come here for a seat, or did you come here to engage in Dharma conversation, to pursue Dharma?" And they're all like really embarrassed, like that they were basically looking for a place to sit down that worked for them. And he says, "Okay, here." And he gives them these imaginary, illusory lotuses and thrones. And then he, after the explanation of his apparent sickness, he then quizzes them and asks them in this ninth chapter, how does a bodhisattva enter the Dharma door of non-duality, thereby setting up the focus, the focal point of the path as being entering into the Dharma door of non-duality, presumably as in distinction from the three doors of liberation in the early tradition, which are emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness. This Dharma door of non-duality sort of includes and goes beyond all three. And so he's focused on how do we get into that Dharma door? What's the secret password? And one by one, he asks them. So, Chris, you want to some extent, talk about what their responses are, how the conversation goes.
Yeah, so we have this whole range of bodhisattvas. We normally don't think about we normally think about like the three main bodhisattvas, but there's just this huge number that are all gathered in his house, and they each, line up to give their answer about how you enter the Dharma door of non-duality. And I'll just read a few of these, maybe a few from the beginning and then a few at the end. And there's sort of a feeling of the answers getting sort of increasingly sophisticated. We could unpack a few and see if that's the case. So we start with the Bodhisattva Dharmavikurvana. He declares, "Noble sir, production and destruction are two, but what is not produced and does not occur cannot be destroyed. Thus, the attainment of the tolerance of the birthlessness of things is the entrance into non-duality." So right at the beginning, we have this emphasis on production, which is something that is going to be a bit of a large topic for the Madhyamakas. So we'll be hearing a lot about production.
And sorry to interrupt, but the attainment of the tolerance of the birthlessness of things is this famous stage in the Bodhisattva's trajectory of the bhumis, attaining the eighth bhumi, sometimes translated as the patient endurance of the uncreated, patience or tolerance of the uncreated or birthlessness of all things. And it's a very specific attainment that marks the transition from what are called the impure bhumis to the pure bhumis. And one is at that point definitely destined to be a Buddha. And the Buddha appears and says what Buddha you're going to be, where and when, and so forth. Sorry,
Yeah,
Chris.
thanks for that. Yeah. So next we hear from Sri Ganda, who declares, "I and mine are two. If there is no presumption of a self, there will be no possessiveness. Thus, the absence of presumption is the entrance into non-duality." We then hear from,
What is
yeah.
presumption?
The absence of presumption, the
It's like,
presumption of a self.
I think it's like the projection, this phrase superimposition or denigration. It's like the presumption that there's something there. But it's neat to like think about like presumably these are like ways that different people have entered the stream or achieved some sort of realization.
So then we hear from Srikuta. Defilement and purification are two. When there is thorough knowledge of defilement, there will be no conceit about purification. So that's quite interesting. If you have thorough knowledge of defilement, then there will be no conceit about purification. And I suppose what I take this to mean is that if you truly understand defilement, you'll understand it to be baseless and essenceless, and therefore no purification will be necessary. It goes on, the path leading to the complete conquest of all conceit is the entrance into non-duality. So what's interesting about a lot of, or maybe all of these, is that and we saw this in the earlier Prajnaparamita literature, is that you have these vast claims, but without much argumentation to support them. So I gave what I thought might have been an explanation of that, but that's not necessarily found within the text itself. And that sort of outlines what Nagarjuna and the later Madhyamaka commentators are going to do. And we'll see this later when we look at the chapter in Westerhof, that these claims that are made may not be the result of philosophical argumentation, but maybe more descriptions of meditative experience. And then the commentators take the task of themselves to provide argumentation for those claims. So I'm just gonna skip ahead. Sort of arbitrarily, page 75 in the source, 167 in our text. The Bodhisattva Prabhaketu declared, "To say that the four main elements are one thing and the etheric space element another is dualistic. The four main elements are themselves the nature of space. The past itself is also the nature of space. The future itself is also the nature of space. Likewise, the present itself is also the nature of space. The gnosis that penetrates the elements in such a way is the entrance into non-duality." So sort of reiterating some of that point about this insight is the result of what is translated here as gnosis, or what we might call samadhi, meditative absorption into the elements, which reveals in some sort of authoritative way that they have the nature of space, which is to say the nature of being uncaused, or in some ways groundless. Derek.
Why gnosis as samadhi, as meditation? Isn't gnosis like wisdom?
That yeah, maybe that's the case.
Or like the wisdom that arises from samadhi and
Yeah, I
meditation.
mean it's wisdom of I understand the word, and I could be wrong about this, to be wisdom of a certain sort that comes from out of a meditative state. So maybe prajna could be a better term. Morgan, I just
Probably translation of prajna.
my understanding of the word gnosis is it's a type of knowing that's not almost not dualistic. It's like it's how you know you're tired, how you know your hand hurts, that kind of knowing. Sort of beyond or how you know deeper things. It's beyond simple, I am here, I know that.
A
I think.
sort of a non-conceptual quality to it,
Yeah.
and like a real quality of veracity.
Yeah.
No one can talk you out of your knowledge that you're tired.
Right.
Emily, did you have something?
Derek said it. I was going to ask or guess that it was a translation of prajna. That was my question and what assumption.
Cool, thanks for that. Let's just so we don't spend all day going through these. We'll start at the bottom of page 76 in the source, page 168 in our text.
Excuse me one second. Is
Yeah.
I have the book in the there's a glossary in the back, and
Oh, cool.
gnosis is jnana. It's just
Jnana.
translation of jnana.
Okay, cool. That's interesting.
Yeah, but in our scheme now, like in the more developed later scheme, jnana being one step up from prajna.
The Bodhisattva, this is at the bottom of page 168 in the source book. The Bodhisattva Manikuttaraja declared, "It is dualistic to speak of good paths and bad paths. One who is on the path is not concerned with good paths or bad paths. Living in such unconcern, he entertains no concepts of path or non-path. Understanding the nature of concepts, his mind does not engage in duality. Such is the entrance into non-duality." I'm just going to just read the rest of this to the end of the chapter. So, top of page 169. The Bodhisattva Satyarata declared, "It is dualistic to speak of true and false. When one sees truly, one does not ever see any truth. So how could one see falsehood? Why? One does not see with the physical eye. One sees with the eye of wisdom. And with the wisdom eye, one sees only insofar as there is neither sight nor non-sight. There, where there is neither sight nor non-sight, is the entrance into non-duality." So at this point, all the bodhisattvas have given their explanations. When the bodhisattvas had given their explanations, they all addressed the crown prince Manjushri. "Manjushri, what is the bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality?" Manjushri replied, "Good sirs, you all have spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing, that is the entrance into non-duality." Then the crown prince Manjushri said to the Lachavi Vimalakirti, "We have all given our own teachings, noble sir. Now may you elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality." Thereupon, the Lachavi Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. The Crown Prince Manjushri applauded the Lachavi Vimalakirti. "Excellent, excellent, noble sir. This is indeed the entrance into the non-duality of the bodhisattvas. Here there is no use for syllables, sounds, and ideas." When these teachings had been declared, 5,000 bodhisattvas entered the door of the Dharma of non-duality and attained tolerance of the birthlessness of things. So we see Vimalakirti best all of the bodhisattvas through not answering this question, showing that from this point of view, non-speech, non-view is the highest view of all. Derek, did you want to say anything about this performance? Touche. All right. Once again, I mean, so we have these real startling, sometimes quite provocative and beautiful, sometimes perplexing answers to this question of how one enters the Dharma door of non-duality, but not, it would appear, a ton in the way of philosophical argumentation. So I think we can now turn to Jan Westerhoff, who can explain a little bit about why that might be the case.
Thank you, Chris. I'll start us off and then you shift over to you or jump in. So we're starting at page 99 of Westerhoff's fine book, The Golden Age of Ageless Gold.
Derek, can I ask something?
Yeah.
So this Vimalakirti, you brought that in as like a bridge to Nagarjuna that he demonstrated
Well,
something.
we brought it in as an example of a sutra, Mahayana sutra of the sort of emptiness class of the Madhyamaka class of Mahayana sutras, so that we're trying to like lead into each section by having the sutra sources. And as I said earlier, it was a little bit chronologically of a different scheme, but we did the both of these sutras, the Prajnaparamita and this, as a lead into Nagarjuna, presuming that he was well versed in these sutras, if not had them memorized. But you were leading to something else, I think.
Well, it just seemed like he demoed what ultimately Nagarjuna was maybe pointing to as well.
Vimalakirti demoed
Yeah.
it by not saying anything. Well, Nagarjuna has that same flavor at some places, saying no Buddha taught anything to anyone at any time, in any place. And that is one of the topics for this whole section, is that sort of conundrum, if you will, I guess. So the teachings of the perfection of wisdom literature. So Westerhoff is saying, in order to understand Nagarjuna or Nagarjuna and his Madhyamaka teachings, we should understand the perfection of wisdom literature. And he's pointing out three particular aspects of it: the criticism of the Abhidharma project, in particular the notion of svabhava, or Dharma, really the notion of dharmas as being truly existent, the doctrine of illusionism, and an explicit acceptance of contradictions. So, things that I found interesting are is that he begins off this criticism of the Abhidharma project, which I just mischaracterize as being focused on the nature of dharmas, is really initially focused on the ideal, the goal of the earlier literature, the earlier tradition, which he's calling the Abhidharma project, but it's really the project of those who put together the Abhidharma project, is that their focus was on self-liberation, and they They don't talk endlessly about liberating all sentient beings as bodhisattvas do. And the language towards them is a little bit harsh. We see in page 100, in that first paragraph or section after the quote, what is criticized here is not the validity or the realization of the hearts and pratyeka buddhas, but their limited scope. The perfection of wisdom, 25,000 verses, compares them to glowworms. I don't really know what a glowworm is, and the bodhisattvas to the sun, but I can imagine that they're nowhere near the sun. Both have kindled the flame of enlightenment, but the former's light only illuminates their own immediate surroundings, whereas that of the latter can potentially light up the whole world. So he goes on to talk a little bit more metaphysically about the difference, and he cites the famous Heart Sutra, our famous Heart Sutra. There are no aggregates, the famous aggregates are empty, and emptiness there are no arrogant aggregates, and so on, all the way up to no attainment. So we have a total negation of all of the work of the Abhidharma project, of all of the dharmas, one after another, in a very formulaic manner, or sort of thoroughgoing manner. And he comments, it's hard to overestimate how radical this step was. The theory of dharmas was the standard Buddhist account of how reality was constituted. If all this is rejected, the audience might well have wondered what, if anything, was left. So he calls it that it was that theory that accounted both for what there is at the rock bottom and what kind of phenomenology, sort of understanding of reality is based on that. So he challenges that whole scheme. And as we've seen from the start, that scheme had difficulties. And he's sort of extrapolating those difficulties out and saying, basically, your logic does not hold water. The second characteristic that Westerhoff focuses on is this notion of illusionism, that this is a recurrent theme in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, is that everything is like an illusion. And as he notes, this is a metaphor that the Buddha himself used in the early sutras, that the aggregates are like an illusion, the world is like an illusion, but the implication in those senses is, in those contexts, was that the clinging to the aggregates as the basis for the self is an illusion. The illusory aspect of the aggregates was their ability to be a valid support for the establishment of a sense of self was an illusion. It was not really that the aggregates themselves did not exist. He says they're, although he does say at various places that they're empty, he says they're impermanent. They're like a ball of, they're like a bubble, a ball of foam, like a mist. These famous 12 analogies for phenomena that the Buddha uses in the early sutras. The Prajnaparamita sutras focus on these and extrapolate them out. In doing so, they give a much deeper ontological sense of meaning to this idea of illusionism, of things being illusory-like. Where in the early sutras, again, it was more like all of these things as the basis for some sense of self are an illusion. And then the third one is this idea of contradictions. And this is something that we find if we read the basically any Prajnaparamita Sutra other than, we don't see this in the Heart Sutra, but anyone that has more complexity to it, we see this constant phrasing of there are no this, and therefore there are these. And he quotes Khans of the Thousands, so I'm on page 104. The thousands of lines of the Prajnaparamita, meaning sutras, can be summed up in the following two sentences. One should become a bodhisattva. And so the Prajnaparamita sutras lay out the path and all the different aspects of the path of a bodhisattva. There's a little a segue, thank you, from our topic, our focus on emptiness. But what we don't often hear about the Prajnaparamita Sutras is that they extrapolate the Bodhisattva path in great detail, in great depth, and in great of what they call vastness, great variety, going through all the different qualities of bodhisattvas at all the different stages of the path, before the bhumis, during each one of the 10 bhumis, and the different ways and styles or sort of levels of realization that the bodhisattvas have. And this then becomes the template for the Mahayana in all of its subsequent sutras and all of its subsequent writings. We're all familiar with Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva, which is sort of the epitome of that, the idiom of the Bodhisattva, the ideal of the Bodhisattva as the perfect human being. And it's just scattered haphazardly throughout these sutras. And so, as I said earlier, there's these later texts that bring all of these qualities of the Bodhisattva path into this amazing order of like what happens when, how different types of liberation occur, and so forth, what the qualities of the various stages. And then, of course, emptiness. So once you become a bodhisattva, there is no such thing as a bodhisattva, or as all knowledge, or as being, or as the perfection of wisdom, or as attainment, nirvana, Buddhas, bodhisattvas. To accept both these contradictory facts is to be perfect. So because we don't conceive of there being anything happening, therefore all things can happen, is the basic logic. Because dharmas have no unchanging intrinsic essence as being what they are, as being some set of properties or capabilities. Therefore, they can function. Therefore, they can interact. They can change. They can be efficacious. And that logic is just repeated endlessly over and over again. So that it's both an like a statement against ontology, as well as it's a clearly a meditative instruction of like if you keep conceiving of yourself as meditating, as doing this, as practicing the perfection of patience or giving or discipline or whatever it is, then you're far from doing it. You're just creating some conceptual projection, and you're not actually cultivating the merit that a bodhisattva needs in order to become a fully enlightened Buddha and help all sentient beings in a limitless way, the way a Buddha can compare to bodhisattvas.
And if I can just
Yeah,
riff
sure.
on that for a bit, I think it's an even stronger claim than just that by thinking you're practicing the meditating on the perfection of patience, that you're not actually doing it. that there might be a real perfection of patience beyond the conceptual overlay that you could be doing if you would stop thinking about it. But they go even further to undermine the possibility, the very ground that a real perfection of patience could exist on. And I think that's what Derek was getting at when he talked about de-ontologizing. So we have in the Abhidharma an idea that there's this world of appearances that we're all caught up in, and that we suffer because we don't understand the irreality of that of those appearances, which is in fact the undergirded by the reality of Dharma.
He's just demonstrating the unreality of dharmas.
Sorry, my internet, rural internet situation.
Froze at a very good moment.
Yeah.
You said undermining the very reality of Dharma, something
But
like that.
that, well, that, and the point I'm trying to make is that in Abhidharma, you have the idea of an illusory overlay with a real nature underneath it that can be accessed through meditative training. And what's sort of new and revolutionary here, most of all, is the idea that not only is the world of appearance is illusory, but that the world of dharmas we might try to ground that apparent world in is also illusory, and that there's no bottom.
No rock bottom, no bottom, no muddy bottom, no anything. Thank you. So then Westerhoff shifts in the last part of this section on page 105 to this issue of Nagarjuna. Who was this guy and what was he up to and where does he sit? And he says on there's this little note on the right that says, "Was Nagarjuna a Mahayanist?" And this is a recurring question. Many books about him and his teachings go over this topic because, in terms of a literary analysis, he doesn't refer to any other Mahayana sutras. Specifically, he has this one, as you see, Westerhoff says, his opening verse of his main text is from the Prajnaparamita Sutras, but that verse in the Prajnaparamita Sutras is a compilation of different lines from different earlier sutras. And his presentation, he doesn't quite say this as much. He indicates it that his texts, the so-called letters to the kings, the Ratnavali and the letter to the king, where he's giving more expository works on the path and the practice of being a bodhisattva or being a Buddhist, really. So much of it is basic. It feels like an early Shravaka-oriented text and practice. There's so many schemes of the Shravaka school, and there's such emphasis on black and white of good and evil, and avoiding desire and things like that, and emphasis on being a monastic. So this is it's an early phase of Mahayana, where whereas with Vimalakirti, we didn't actually see that in our excerpts, but some of the things that happens in that sutra is he blows away the idea of monks being superior to householders. He blows away this idea of men being superior to women. And pretty radical things for that time period. But we don't see that in this early period. We see the old mindset where here and there there's little male chauvinist statements, and there's definitely statements of preference of monastics against non-monastics. So in some sense you could take these texts by Nagarjuna and say, well, he's just a radical Abhidharmist, Abhidharmaka, who just like is going all the way to the other extreme of like somebody maybe who's like struggled with the Sarvastivada and the Trantaka or Theravada ways of explaining how partless particles can conglomerate and things like that, and how karma can be passed on from one moment to the next, and just like throwing his hands up and say, none of this makes any sense. Do you want to add anything to that and then go into the next section, Chris?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's there's been as Derek said, a certain amount of scholarly attention to this theory that maybe Nagarjuna was no Mahayanist at all, but someone, an Abhidharmaka proposing a radical revision to the Abhidharma project in an attempt to purify it of the errors its proponents make. And so in order to do that, first is that we would have to contain the so Nagarjuna is said to have three bodies of writings, more or less. The first is these famous six works of argumentation, otherwise known as the Yukti corpus, and the most famous of which is the Mulamadhyamakakarika, the fundamental verses of the middle way, which we'll be reading in 2 weeks. And that's sort of Westerhoff says that that text is as associated with Nagarjuna as the Iliad or the Odyssey is with Homer. That usually when we're talking about Nagarjuna, we're talking about the Mulamadhyamakakarikas. But he also wrote, as Derek referenced, these letters to kings, and there's some sort of mythical accounts about who those kings are. The Ratnavali, the story goes that he's getting there's the Nagarjuna runs into a cowherd, and he asks the cowherd to escort him across a river. But then in the river, Nagarjuna makes a bunch of crocodiles appear through magical illusion and rescues the cowherd rescues Nagarjuna from the crocodiles, and then Nagarjuna says, "I'll give you anything, any magical spell I can cast for you." So the cowherd wishes to become a king. So Nagarjuna summons elephants and armies and palaces for this cowherd, who is now a king. And then the Ratnavali is written for him. So that's sort of the mythical account of that, how that text came about. But yeah, so we have these letters to kings, and those are most assuredly Mahayana sources. So looking at those texts, there can be no argument that Nagarjuna is an Abhidharmaka. And then we have what are known as the collection of praises. And the most famous of these is in praise of Dharmadhatu. And these are radically different and belong to what are generally known as, referred to as the third turning of teachings, the teachings that expound on Buddha nature. And present a very different philosophical picture than the one we get in the Karikas or in the other argumentative texts. Are there more than one Nagarjuna? That is another hypothesis that's been made. In addition to these texts, we have tantric texts. We have some texts on medicine. There's apparently a Nagarjuna recipe for making incense, and dental. There's like an oral health text. Hundreds of texts. So the question of which Nagarjuna there was, how many there were, which text can accurately be ascribed to him, is very much an open question. We know very little about the details of his life, other than that he was a monk who lived somewhere in southern India, around the 150 to 250 of the Common Era. But beyond that, it's very difficult to pin him down. So we're left with a lot of questions like these. So to return to the original question about was he actually an Abhidharmaka, Westerhoff addresses this, and this is at the bottom of page 106 in the source. And this is in response to this claim that he might be an Abhidharmaka. First, a fact that the earlier authors overlooked, even though it had already been pointed out by Kanzi, who's the translator of the Prajnaparamita that we read last week, some time ago, is that in the salutary verses, the Namaskara, in the praise of the Buddha by which Nagarjuna begins his Mulabhadhyamaka-karika, are clearly derived from a passage in the Perfection of Wisdom in the 25,000 verses. Interestingly, though, this citation consists largely of phases that occur individually in the early Buddha sutras, though not in the form in which they are put together here. The Namaskara thereby fulfills a curious double function. On the one hand, putting a section of a Prajnaparamita text at the very beginning of this key treatise conveys a clear signal about the intellectual lineage in which Nagarjuna wants to position his work. On the other hand, nothing forces this reading. All the terms Nagarjuna uses here can be found in the sutras of the Tripitaka. The reason for this, and for the prevalence of non-Mahayana citations in the Mulabhadhyamaka-karika, as well as for the absence of explicit references to Mahayana texts, Walser has argued, lies in the specific historical situation of the Mahayana movement found itself in during Nagarjuna's times. As a minority school, it was trying to promote the acceptance of its interpretation to a majority of Abhidharmakas. It would obviously have been of very little use to try to do this by reference to Mahayana sutras, even though these explicitly endorsed the superiority of the Mahayana interpretation, they were not accepted as authoritative by the Abhidharmakas. Nagarjuna's strategy, therefore, was to argue for Mahayana conclusions by restricting himself to explicit references to texts that both the Abhidharmakas and the Mahayanists would consider authoritative. We see a milder form of the problem Buddhists later faced when debating with non-Buddhist opponents. Obviously, such debates could not make any reference to scriptural authority, since the two parties did not acknowledge each other's canons. But in the Buddhist case, there was a shared canon, and Nagarjuna set out to demonstrate that the Tripitaka texts that the Abhidharmakas regarded as authoritative could be given a Mahayana reading. This is sort of a curious image here. This procedure might remind us of the cuckoo and her eggs, but there is no reason to believe that matters appeared this way to a thinker like Nagarjuna. His aim was to bring out what he considered to be the authentic meaning of the Buddha's teachings and to do so in a manner that would convince the largest possible number of his co-religionists.
What's the image, the cuckoo and her eggs? Anyone know?
I know this because I just saw this in a documentary with my kids, where a cuckoo comes in and lays its egg in a nest, another
Of
bird's
some
nest, where there are
birds,
already eggs. And then it's wild. They show this in this documentary. The cuckoo egg hatches, and then this little newborn baby chick that can't even open its eyes or anything, like from instinct, pushes all the other eggs out of the nest. So it's the only baby left. And then the other bird, the mama bird from the nest, comes and feeds it without realizing it's not her baby. And it gets to this point where the cuckoo's like this big and the mom bird is like this big. And it's this bizarre image. So I don't know if they're including all the details, but I literally just saw this like 2 nights ago.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, what a bizarre phenomenon in the natural world. What
So
the
I think just to cash that out, I think the idea is Nagarjuna sneaking his arguments into the Abhidharmaka's nests in a way they won't notice in order to push out the, I guess, other Abhidharmaka arguments. But Westerhoff's saying that he doesn't think that's what he's doing, merely that he's not being sneaky, but guided by an authentic desire to expound the Buddha's true meaning to other Buddhists who would need it to be explained to them in their own language. And I think what we see here also is an early endorsement of what will become a key Madhyamaka style of argumentation, which is to not use your own hypotheses, but to use the hypotheses of the people with whom you are arguing. And to use them in such a way that draws out their own absurd premises, which we will learn about later and is known as prasanga.
Interesting technique. It's like jiu-jitsu, right? You like you have the opponent come and you use their own momentum to destroy them. One thing he doesn't mention is that the Namaskara could well have been added later. I'm surprised he doesn't mention that because that often happens with texts. Anyway, so let's dive into the key themes. And Chris, you want to go into this first?
Yeah, and just keeping an eye on time, I think it's going to be clear that we're not going to be able to do real justice to all these themes, but to not worry because many of them are going to be repeated or dealt with in greater detail in our reading for next week. So we can kind of give a somewhat cursory treatment tonight and read some more about them in over the next week, discuss further. So first we have his treatment of the Abhidharma project, which we've discussed some of the criticism already, but I think it's also important to realize that he doesn't have a wholesale rejection of Abhidharma in a way. Here we go. This is a bottom of page 108, magical number. Nagarjuna's attitude is therefore very far from a wholesale rejection of the teachings of Abhidharma. In this context, he explicitly recommends the close study of one of its topical lists. In fact, there would have been no reason for rejecting Abhidharma doctrine's Tok court. They are, after all, an attempt to systematize, explicate, and develop the teachings contained in the Buddha's sutras of early Buddhism. And the fact that Nagarjuna considered some of these explanations, even very central ones, as mistaken, does not mean he would have rejected them all. Even though it is difficult to be definite about this, there may have been a political, or to use a favorite Mahayana term, skillful, upaya, dimension, to Nagarjuna's acceptance or endorsements of certain Abhidharma positions. This is next paragraph. The key metaphysical notion of the Abhidharma that Nagarjuna attacks is that of svabhava, or intrinsic nature. His theory of emptiness means that all things are empty of intrinsic nature. In early Buddhist teachings, the doctrine of emptiness was primarily spelled out as the selflessness of persons, arguing that there is no permanent, self-sufficient personality core that notions like I, me, or mind picked out. With Mahayana, the domain of emptiness is expanded so that it covered all non-persons as well. In addition to the selflessness of persons, it gave a prominent position to the selflessness of all dharmas. The idea of the emptiness of dharmas is not entirely straightforward. Where a person might be considered to possess a substantial soul or atman, other things do not do so in any obvious sense. For this reason, we need a more general notion about what all empty things, persons and non-persons, are empty of. And this is the notions of svabhava. Nagarjuna characterizes svabhava by two important properties. It is not adventitious and is not dependent on anything else. So adventitious, we often talk about the adventitious stains, and in this case, I take it to mean non-essential.
Well,
So it is not the swabhava is not non-essential. Suffice to say, it is essential. It is a thing's essence, the ground of the thing itself. And the common, usually we talk about the svabhava of fire, the heat of fire. It is not adventitious and it is not dependent on something else. If we recall the notions of svabhava we find in Abhidharma, we remember that an object has some property as its svabhava if this property does not depend on other things apart from the thing that brought the object into existence in the first place. Thus, a chariot is no chariot by svabhava because it borrows its nature from its simultaneously existent components. The great elements, the Mahabhuta, like water, fire, and so on, do not derive their nature from anything else. They have their nature by swabhava, yet the Abhidharma has no difficulties with accepting that they are causally produced. But we just saw Nagarjuna say that dependent things cannot exist by swabhava, and a causally produced dharma is, of course, dependent on the causes and conditions that brought it into existence. It seems as if the Abhidharma and Nagarjuna meant quite different things when they spoke of swabhava. And if this is the case, we might wonder whether Nagarjuna's rejection of swabhava, setting out to explicate its rejection in the Perfection of Wisdom texts, is really a rejection of the swabhava that the Abhidharmakas had in mind, or whether it is the rejection of something else.
Yeah, so maybe we could talk there a little bit about this whole swabhava thing. First, I just had to come to memory that swabhava does not actually appear in the early sutras in a major way.
Right.
And that it's a creation of the students of the Buddha, let's say, afterwards, as a way of explaining how things are and how things exist. And in doing so, then all the problems begin. But what are the ways, when he says they're talking about two different versions of swabhava? So the Abhidharma version, I think, of swabhava is that swabhavas have an essence as being what they are. They're not adventitious, but they are causally produced, dependently produced. And in their production, it's more that their appearance their arising is produced, not their essence of what they are. If that makes any sense, as two different things. It's like, okay, there's fire, and this brings it about, but it brings about its appearance. Okay, now that thing that we call fire is here, as opposed to fire being produced by different things coming together and then being called fire, if that makes any sense. And also,
it makes sense, but it's also going to depend on which Abhidharma system we're talking about, right? So within Sarvastivada, there is this idea that the Dharma are eternal, right? And that they come into, when they're in the present, they have causal power, but that is a separate factor from their existence in the three times.
Right. So it could be that one, but go to the next one.
The next one is the Sautantrikas. And for them, dharmas exist momentarily. They have no temporal thickness. And they arise and endure and cease sort of in a single moment. But in doing so, they set the next dharma up. So the dharma at time one causes the dharma at time two.
Okay, so those are the differences. But I think for both of them, it's like there's this, it's like Plato's image type of thing. It's like there's this vast reservoir of dharmas as potencies, potentials. And when causes and conditions come about in such a way, like friction and carbon substance, poof, an instance of fire dharma appears. As opposed to like fire dharma having some breakdown into different things, if that makes any sense.
So the instance of fire dharma is not dependent on different parts, and it can't be broken down conceptually either.
Right, right. And also, I wanted to ask this thing. Talk about the uniqueness of fire. It seems to me among the elements, earth, water, fire, and air, that three of them are there like all the time. And you can't like say, okay, how do you produce water? Water came about, or earth was produced, or air was produced. But fire is not there all the time. And how and fire is produced. And it just seems like a different animal from the other guys. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, I think fire is, it's a useful philosophical, illustration, because much more than, you strike a match and then fire shows up.
Right.
And, I don't know if they had plumbing in the same way we do, where you could t turn the faucet and the water shows up. There's sort of the immediacy of not there and then there.
But with the water, the water was somewhere
It was in
else.
the pipes, and then, sure.
It doesn't like appear out of nothing, whereas fire appears out of nothing in an interesting way. Cynthia.
Just a question in that the elements, obviously there's the tangible ones that we're talking about, the water that you see and feel and all that, but there's also there's that concept of the elements as these qualities, so the quality of heat, the quality of what do you want to call it, cohesiveness, I guess is what they call water, and the quality of movement is what they call air, right? And what's oh solidity is earth. So when we're talking about the elements here, are we talking about them in the sense of these tangible appearances that we experience, or are we talking about, like, because when they talk about how those elements are in our body, those aren't, the fire element is not a little flame anywhere, but it's just the quality of heat and digestion and all that stuff, right? So I'm just wondering, like, which
That's exactly
definition
what it goes to, right? That's
So which
exactly what
definition
this
of
issue.
element are we really talking about when we're talking about elements in these schools?
Yeah, so if we're talking about the these elements in terms of like these cosmic capabilities, qualities, that the idea seems to be that they're like pervasive.
We looked at the idea of the basic octet. Was that all matter had the four great elements, and then the sort of the four sense bases, or four of the sense bases in them.
Right, and so these are like ever present everywhere.
And I guess I kind of read Cynthia's question as being like, okay, so what's the relationship between those little tiny fire as bases and like the flame in front of you?
Yeah, we never really got there to the to conglomerates.
Well, right. I mean, because in a sense, what I'm trying to figure out is when we're talking here about this question of whether, you said something about arising being causally produced, things are, they arise as from causes and conditions, but the nature is already there. It's not like the nature. So I'm just trying to figure out which aspect we're talking about, whether we're
I
talking.
was trying to push the boundary between the two aspects. I was intentionally trying to go from one to the other, and then
But still within Sao Tantrica, you do have this idea of the basic octet, right? But that basic octet is causing another basic octet at the next moment. It's not as though there's anything that endures from one moment to the next.
and the octet that we're talking about is these little collections of sorry, the different qualities that make up the whatever this smallest is it a dharma at this point of water or fire or whatever it is.
I think what, and I'm not sure Derek and I entirely agree on this. I think that what you are describing as qualities, these tiny little bases, those are the dharmas.
Well, what I'm talking about, I guess, is yeah, the qualities which, I guess the question is, of course, are we talking about there are there is there matter in this in the, I mean, we're in a world here worldview that does deal with matter, right? So there's matter and mind.
Yeah.
So to me, these
And
qualities.
they're both kind of in the same place. It's not this Cartesian split off situation.
Okay, because I guess that's probably part of my, challenges to, for me, the qualities are kind of more of a concept, obviously, in the mind, but they are these little octets that you were talking about or whatever are actually kind of both the quality and the matter,
I
total
think so.
blobs of matter.
I think so. But I also think that the question of how the little components relate to the philosophical term, the medium-sized dry goods, although I suppose not all of them are dry in this case, but the phenomena that inhabit the world we live around, I think we can actually bracket that. And that's not totally relevant for this question of Swabhava. We could simply say there are very small things, and in some way they add up to big things, and not get too into the weeds about how that happens.
Yeah, no, that's, I guess that's okay. I just want, but what we're talking about in terms of something being, right, we're not trying to figure out how they all stack up and make a thing,
Right.
an observable thing for us. But
Yeah.
what we are still talking about, though, whether they, this getting back to this, trying to stay with the Svabhava question, do they, Derek was sort of going through this, do they arise? And in what way do they arise and in which, and all of that.
I was sort of pushing the issue of of how they arise using the example of fire and getting us to the point of it being an ever-present quality where so it's somewhat similar, I think, to like water going from gas to liquid to ice, and fire goes from like this warmth to okay, you exacerbate it and it becomes a flame sort of thing.
And also, there's warmth like in the bodies, for example. That would be considered warmth as well, right?
That's what I started with, warmth.
Right, okay.
That warmth, yeah. And but there's something I'm trying to build towards that I'd like to. But Emily, chime in here and then I'll continue.
I was just going to add it's important for me anyway to continually remember that these guys didn't have the tools we have in terms of understanding scientifically where fire comes from. So if you don't have those tools and understanding, I don't think it's weird to, when you're looking at a flame suddenly arising, to imagine there was sort of this invisible fire
Potential.
potentiality that was sort of there, and then it appears, and then it goes away, and but it doesn't really go away. That yeah, that it's not weird to me that they came up with this.
Imagine seeing fire like for the first time. Anyway, the part I love and what really want to get to is this idea that every moment there's this complex amalgamation of different dharmas that are assembled in octaves, making up these atoms. And separate from this issue of how do they compile into dry goods, how this idea that they arise for an instant and then they disappear, and then they get, somehow their disappearance or something gives rise to the next moment of an assemblage of dharmas. And
And this conundrum is something Nagarjuna seizes on.
totally. And so I think it's interesting to flesh this out and get this the Abhidharma view of this to the extent possible of in their world then, how did the observable universe change? If every moment things are creating the next moment of their likeness or their continuum or whatever you call it, how do things morph and get all? And why is there, how did fire go from a potential or a warmth to a flame? How does water, that idea that, okay, one moment there's this assemblage and they just replicate themselves the next moment. What tinkers with the situation to get things to change? They don't seem to I don't remember them
Do they
really
change?
addressing that.
Do they change?
in appearance, like
Certainly
there's
seem to have.
warmth and then there's flame. So I don't know if it's it. It's not, maybe you're implying, well, the it hasn't changed because that it is no longer here. But the,
Yeah, and when that would be the Srivastavadin kind of argument is that, well, it was here and then it's gone and it didn't change. It was just showed up momentarily and then left and something else took its place.
But that something else is different. So like, what's the logic for the predictability? Like, why doesn't it turn into a banana? Or, there's fire one moment and then there's fire the next moment. Why isn't it like fire and then there's something completely different?
It does seem, I mean, here we're talking about the momentariness where it's, yeah, the thing again and again and again. I tend to think of it like a strobe light, it's there.
Yeah. And so the implication is, well, a moment of fire produces the next moment of fire. But then why doesn't it fire all the time?
And so then it would seem, I mean, I'm just making this up, of course, is that it continues to make the same thing until some new condition or cause comes in.
Right. And so where did something new ever come from?
That is a really good question.
And according to the theory of dharmas, that new thing couldn't have come from the fire itself because the fire they're mereologically simple. They can't have parts. There can't be a part inside of it that turns it off at a certain point.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking simple example since we're talking about fire is that fire keeps going until somebody dumps a bucket of water onto it, since we're in the element world here, or until somebody removes all the air from the situation, right? That's what actually stops fire from continuing to reproduce itself, it seems.
It's just there's such a huge contradiction in their worldview there, on this sort of atomistic ontological level that it's I'm like puzzled that they don't talk that we didn't encounter that.
Well,
We talked about
lucky for
change to
you.
sense
Lucky for you, Nagarjuna
instantaneous.
loves to talk about this. He loves to talk about it.
Well, he
And
talks about the absurdity of it. I want the
using our
Abhidharma to
same
support it.
metaphor of fire, Jan Westerhoff is going to talk about it on page 110. This is sort of a little bit into the third paragraph. Causal production happens in a sequence. First, there is a cause, say a spark, and later, at a later time, the effect arises, the explosion. But this entails that the causal relation is always missing one related object. When the cause exists, the effect does not yet exist. And the effect exists, the cause has already passed out of existence. Since the joint premise of presentism and momentariness have squeezed the whole of reality into the present moment, and since this causal relation requires at least two successive moments, one relatum, or one part of the relationship, one relatum of this relation will always fail to exist. It seems as if this shows that causation does not exist, since there cannot be two place relations without two relata. Yet the world appears to us as causal through and through, and the Madhyamaka has to find a way to account for this. He does so by suggesting that even though effect cannot exist at the same time as the cause, the idea of the effect can. When the cause exists, the effect is supplied by an anticipation. When the spark flashes, we expect the explosion. When the effect has arisen, the cause is supplied by memory. We remember the spark when the explosion happens. What this means is that the causal relation inevitably contains at least one relatum that is a conceptual construct. And if this is the case, causation cannot be an objective relation that obtains in a mind-independent matter. So what he's saying is that the notion of causality is inherently tied up in our own minds and our own projections and cannot be viewed as mind independent. But this means that the essence of such things involves conceptual construction, and anything that does so cannot exist by svabhava, since it entails that the object is not what it is all by itself, but in dependence on other things such as conceptualizing minds. For this reason, all causally produced things must be empty. How does that strike everyone?
Like a match. It just seems so clear that they're talking about two different swabhavas. It seems to me.
Well, I think the question that he proposes is it may not be they're talking about two different swabhavas, but they're certainly talking about two different notions of causality and two different notions of time.
So Derek, if it's two different svabhavas, what is the second one? If the first one is the one that was described with those two properties of not adventitious and not dependent on something else, then what would, if that's one definition of svabhava, what's the other one that we're thinking?
Dependent. Svabhava that are dependent.
Svabhava that are dependent.
Yeah. That are dependent in the way that Derek outlined earlier, they can be caused by events in time, by a previous moment in time. So they're not dependent in the way that a chariot is dependent on the parts of a chariot, but they're dependent on the previous moment of themselves or something in their sort of causal stream.
As in the Pratityasamutpada world, where the Buddha says, you know, if this is present, then this comes about, and so forth. So it's not a one-to-one causal relationship, but it's like a web. And that the dharmas are dependent in that way. Mary Beth.
Which one of those two different kinds of svabhava is where svabhava means nature?
I think both. So it's sort of like how you conceive of a nature as being something that, like Nagarjuna is attacking a nature that, well, if you say it is this quality, then it's always that quality.
When you say quality, do you mean like, you mean
nature.
That as nature? Okay.
Nature, essence, nature, quality. It's nature is the quality of this or that, hardness or fluidity or attachment or things like that.
So is the difference it's caused or it's not caused? One nature example is caused and one nature that is not caused, it's just always there, not caused.
I think it's sort of like the you know, so to jump to the conclusion, since we're close to out of time, and as Chris said, we will go through these aspects again next week in the readings next week. We basically go through the same stuff. It seems to be a matter of how one approaches the notion of dharma as like setting up an absolute versus having like if one has a fluid understanding of dharmas, then emptiness comes more easily or naturally than if one has an absolutist, concretized, like simplistic, like in order to explain things, like making things very simple and clunky, the clunkiness that Chris has referred to a number of times. But anyway, why don't you continue for the remainder and lead us on, Chris?
I just want to kind of jump to Westerhoff's conclusion of are the Swabhavas the same or different? And what he says, last sentence of page 111, the Abhidharmika and the Madhyamaka do not operate with different conceptions of Swabhava and are therefore not talking past each other. They do, however, have different conceptions of causation, and this has repercussions on their views of the kinds of things that are the kinds of things to be considered as having Swabhava in the first place. So we'll leave it at that. So that was the first argument, was the argument against causation. The second argument against Swabhava that Westerhoff turns to is the Mariological argument against Swabhava. Mariology is the parts. The second main, then I'm just starting from that next paragraph. The second main argument against Swabhava Nagarjuna discusses is not based on the notion of causation, but the problem of the identity or difference of wholes and parts. The argumentative structure will be familiar to us from Abhidharma arguments setting out to show that wholes cannot be ultimately real objects, but must be conceptually constructed. Once again, the chariot cannot be real because it's made of parts, and it's just a superimposition we make on top of those parts. This is a little later, but it turns out that both the assumption that the whole is identical with the parts and the assumption that a separate identity from the parts lead us to problems. From this, the Abhidharmikas infer that the wholes are no entities in their own rights, that they do not exist in the same sense as their parts, but are merely conceptual superimpositions on the parts. Nagarjuna now continues this argument on the level of dharmas. That is, he applies it to the entities that came out as ultimately real according to the Mariological argument of the Abhidharmikas. Of course, he cannot do so with the reference to the first criterion for being a dharma, Mariological simplicity, i.e. having no parts, as dharmas have no parts. Instead, he focuses on a second, the idea that the ultimately real objects must also be simple, not just in terms of material decomposition, but also when it comes to conceptual decomposition. So to go back to the basic octet can't be taken apart materially, but we can dissect it conceptually and determine that there are eight individual components. So he's going to take this even further. And being sensitive to time, gets into whether or not we have the idea of the dharma on one hand and the properties on the other. So we have the dharma of fire and the properties of heat, and he's going to drill into whether or not that makes it two things. What he calls a bare particular on one hand, the dharma of fire that holds the quality of heat, and then says, well, if that's the case, there must be another thing underneath them, and this sets up an infinite regress, sort of turtles all the way down. He entertains a second possibility, which is like, okay, well, maybe this idea of dharmas was wrong in the first place, and all we have are tropes, little particular qualities, heat, cohesion, movement, and so on, and that those are the real dharmas. But then it becomes very difficult to locate them because they're just qualities on sort of like a Platonic form. So we need time and space to locate them, but where are time and space? Those would need to be dharmas as well. So, okay, maybe we can locate them in a web of that this heat dharma is, we can pick it out by saying it's connected with these other dharmas that it's surrounded by. Yeah? The problem is then the idea is that a dharma is supposed to be able to stand in a lonely state, is supposed to be an individual essence that we can point to without having to draw on other essences, the thing in itself. And if we identify a thing in terms of a web of causal relations, we are not doing that at all. So in one case, we have turtles all the way down, and in this case, we have turtles all the way around. It's sort of like the idea of, you know, that you do it on like a corporate retreat or something, the trust building exercise where everyone sits on each other's lap at the same time. And you're all able to stand, like hold each other up by sitting on each other's laps. So that's the image here.
What corporation was that? That's pretty kinky. I've never seen that occur.
All right, maybe I
Sitting
don't
on each other's
is it
laps.
clear I've never been to a corporate retreat?
I think so. You'd be
All right, but
thrown
it's, you know, it's
out
like
of
a
the
trust
room.
building exercise. I don't know. Maybe it's like a teen trust. I don't know, man. This is I'm out of my depth.
It'd be the exercise is like you stand in a circle and
You stand in a circle.
you have to pass the orange or the ball to people like that are not right next to you. And you start out, you don't tell people where to stand. And people naturally stand like in a circle where they're sort of arm's length from each other and they're throwing it and they drop it and it takes time. And then the facilitator says, don't think there's no rules here of like gives little hints. And finally you realize that you can all stand right next to each other and one person holds it and everybody puts their hands on it simultaneously and then it's rotated through the order of the people instantaneously. So next time you're at the corporate retreat, you know the answer that way. Anyway.
Yeah, and if this class was meeting in person, we'd, all have to do these exercises together. So, hey, you can consider yourselves lucky.
Musical chairs. I love that one. Anyway, that
and
was
then, so
great.
then, and finally, his third argument is the argument from change, which is very, very briefly now. He says, if the water is hot now and cold later, what could account for this change? And then he explains why that's going to be a problem. Where does the heat dharma go? And how does it change into a non-heat dharma? So those are his three main issues that Westerhoff seizes on. And then we have a description of illusionism, which is I think is Westerhoff's own term. Which again sets up this idea of the world as it appears, just as we saw in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the world as it appears is mere illusion, and that there's no ontological ground to it. We often think about this as Nagarjuna as doing ontology, but what he's kind of doing is de-ontologizing. The pre-existing Abhidharma project, sort of removing the bottom level from their scheme. And then we have this exploration of contradictions. This is page of top of page 18. When we reject the view that things are empty, does that not mean that we say that they are non-empty? Denying both seems to be contradictory. But even if we have managed to do so, Nagarjuna then points out that the denial of both is to be rejected as well. And Westerhoff basically suggests that the correct reading of these contradictions is through the lens of the two truths, which allows us to understand that the Buddha was the greatest teacher of all on a relative level. But that on an ultimate level, he taught nothing. So, yeah, any thoughts in closing? Derek or anyone else? All right. Vimalakirti would be proud.
Where does it leave us?
Right where we started.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you,
Let's
Derek.
close with our dedication chant.
Creator's love.
By this merit may all obtain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigyas wisdom bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled, may all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
See you next week.